had so dutifully earned. The shiny angel never showed up. I was talking with a woman I've known for some time who lost her first husband to cancer and whose second husband was recently diagnosed with the same disease. Multiplying the stress in her life is the fact that her older son was arrested for embezzlement and is serving jail time. Her younger son is being treated for alcoholism. Her granddaughter just lost her newborn baby to SIDS. And the mounting expenses from all these situations leave her financially strained every month. She's been thinking about this potholed path she's been walking for some time now and wanted to bounce her reflections off me. With earnest eyes, she looked at me and said, "Pastor Brady, I have served God and tithed to His church all my life. Can I ask you a simple question? Where is my reward?" Her question punched me in the gut. This was no simple issue she'd raised. After such faithfulness on her part, why wouldn't God do this? I wrapped an arm of comfort around her shoulders and let the question sit unaddressed for the moment. She wasn't really looking for answers right then. She was looking for someone who cared. I thought of how many times I've stood in her shoes, and the memories came flooding back. I watched my mom and dad live by the work-hard code for decades, and yet still struggle to make ends meet. I myself was the embodiment of diligence and was still passed over for promotions I deserved. My devoted wife wanted desperately to become pregnant for years, but instead found her womb empty month after month. You and I both have been there, haven't we? In that place of having shown up to do what's ours to do and feeling frustrated that God never came. The burdens never lifted, the trials never abated, the troubles never vacationed, the blessings never arrived. I squared my shoulders to the dear woman and with gentleness said, "Let's reframe things for a moment, okay? When you leave here, you're headed out to the parking lot where a car that you own is waiting for you, right?" She nodded as I went on. "And you're going to drive that car home to a house you also own, a house that has lockable doors and reliable heat. And then you'll fix dinner, correct? Which will mean that, just as is the case every other day of your life, you've eaten 3 square meals in one day." She exhaled a little, having sorted out where I was going with all of this. "Top 5%, I said to her. "You're in the top 5% of all the people in the world. If you want to make this about material stuff, then remember, you're in far better shape than the other 95%. And yet this wasn't about material stuff. She knew it, and so did I. What it really was about was the stuff of assurance, of knowing that God hadn't lost her file. And the only way she was going to find her footing here was to slow down, look up, and seek peace. It is in our rest that we regain awareness of God, that we're reminded His nearness is our coveted reward. When Dallas Willard died in 2013, heaven gained a real champion of the faith. Considered by most people to be an expert on spiritual formation, he wrote often and well on the topic of how we become more like Christ, how we get formed into the newness of life we're promised when we go God's way instead of our own. See Galatians 2, verses 19 and 20. Here is a great example of his writing from The Spirit of the Discipline. Human life cannot flourish as God intended it to in a divinely inspired and upheld corporate rule over this grand globe if we see ourselves as on our own, and especially if we struggle to preserve ourselves that way. When we are in isolation from God and not in the proper social bonds with others, we cannot rule the earth for good. The idea is simply absurd. The key to flourishing, I think Willard would have agreed, is not doing away with our problems, but rather the drawing near to God. I've certainly found this to be true. You get alone with God and you realize that what you've magnified to monster status, God quickly minimizes to the size of a mouse. He says, "Look, I know you're tangled up in knots over this set of circumstances, but you've got to believe me when I tell you it's okay. Keep coming to me, and I'll show you the way out. It's a path I've already lovingly paved. Granted, I'm not saying we'll always like the path. What I'm saying is, it's where we'll find peace." This is what the woman needed. Her big problems upheld by God's even bigger hands. It's what we all need, in fact. We all need to be reminded that God is near to us and that He passionately and protectively cares. We observe the Sacrament of Communion most every weekend at New Life Church. It hasn't always been this way, but for the past year or so, we have made it a priority to remind ourselves of God's presence and power in this way every time we gather to worship. I've noticed something during the past 12 months. It's hard to hustle through the wine and the bread. It's nearly impossible to still the soul when the body is still rushing around. And that's a very good thing. We need to stop. We need to savor. We need to consider His presence enough. In The Practice of the Presence of God, 17th century monk Brother Lawrence wrote of the believer, "If sometimes he is a little too much absent from that divine presence, God presently makes Himself to be felt in his soul to recall him, which often happens when he is most engaged in his outward business. He answers with exact fidelity to these inward drawings, either by an elevation of his heart toward God, or by a meek and fond regard to him, or by such words as love forms upon these occasions, as, for instance, My God, here I am all devoted to Thee. Lord, make me according to Thy heart." In other words, God's presence is always there for the taking. This is why we practice communion with regularity, to tell God once again that we wish to be inwardly drawn to Him, that we understand our reward is Him. Several weeks ago, following communion, I prayed a prayer written by Martin Lloyd-Jones to our congregation. "Throughout the whole of this day, everything I do and say and attempt and think and imagine is going to be done under the eye of God. He is going to be with me. He sees everything. He knows everything. There is nothing I can do or attempt, but God is fully aware of it all." A prayer like this can petrify us. Yikes, His eye is always on me? Or we can be uplifted by it. Day by day, I'm learning to choose the uplift. I'm learning to see His presence as my reward. Breaking busy. Challenge number one, name your three. As you listen to this chapter, you may have thought about lessons you've learned about rest that you wish you would have known before. Go ahead and list them out. What are your top three takeaways about rhythmic living that, had you known sooner, could have saved you a boatload of pain and grief and spinning out of control days? Challenge number two, keep your tank full. Next, write out your strategy for abiding by those lessons from this moment forward, for living with a tank that is full. For you, it may mean enlisting a friend who will tell you the truth if you start running on empty again. It may mean assigning a consistent prayer time with God each morning, so that you stay clear on priority number one. It may mean scheduling quarterly appointments with a counselor, so that you can stay true to who you say you want to be. It may mean signing off of social media for a while, if the temptation to live distracted is simply too much to take. It may mean crafting something of a personal manifesto regarding breaking your addiction to busy and posting it on your bathroom mirror so that you see it each time you brush your teeth. Whatever will help you keep your commitment to living with a tank that is full, do that thing and do it now. Chapter 10, Come Alive. Here is the test to find whether your mission on earth is finished. If you're alive, it isn't. Richard Bach. Mission requires margin. It's a current take on a tale of old aimed at kids, I can tell. The animation, a dead giveaway here. The video's opening scene depicts five cool-looking, trendily dressed friends sitting around, talking, laughing, and enjoying the view of the mountains. There are two girls, three guys, and a donkey. One of the guys, not the one with the bleach blonde mohawk, one of the others, sees Jesus approaching them far off and stands up to ask him a question as he nears. "Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" he asks, to which Jesus, who is wearing a long-sleeve blue waffle t-shirt, skinny jeans, and flip-flops, says, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself," says the questioner, the one known as an expert in the law. You have answered correctly, says Jesus. Do this, and you will live. The guy scratches his head, mulling this over a bit. He was trying to test Jesus, and so he probed a little further. And who is my neighbor? The scene changes, as Jesus, in customary form, proceeds to answer a question with a story. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, he says, when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. The man on screen, shaggy hair, goatee, bloodied white t-shirt, jeans, boots, is now writhing in pain there on the dirt. A priest happened to be going down the same road, Jesus continues, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. As Jesus narrates, we see both the head-dressed priest and the Levite clad in drab browns come by, take in the man in pain, and continue on. But then a third passerby, a bald hipster, enters the scene, a Samaritan, Jesus calls him, who came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and, crouching down, bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, brought him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, the Samaritan said, and when I return I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. The scene shifts again, and now we see all 3 passers-by in the same shot, the pious priest, the monkish Levite, and the rather unholy-looking Samaritan. Jesus eyes the friends who were sitting around shooting the breeze, hoping to catch Jesus in a dilemma, and asks, "Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers?" The expert in the law realizes he has absolutely no way out. "The one who had mercy on him," he said, to which the backward baseball cap-wearing Jesus said, "Go and do likewise." The man leaves Jesus' presence, turning to walk through a door that has mysteriously appeared there in the desert, turns the knob, and enters our modern-day world, filled with bustling city streets, tall buildings, hungry families, shelterless single moms, crying babies who desperately need a diaper change, and more. A world in need, thousands upon thousands of neighbors to have mercy upon. Much has been made of the parable of the Good Samaritan down through the ages, and for good reason. Humans have always had trouble considering others' needs ahead of their own. This isn't merely a 21st century predicament. It's a dilemma as old as the hills. I read the parable, or in this case, see it acted out, now through the lens of the Sabbath, of bedhead days, of rhythm and righteousness and rest. And what I discover is that mission requires margin. I won't help another in need until I first create the space that helpfulness requires. The Math of Rest. The Talmud, Judaism's central text, contains an interesting teaching on the Sabbath, which is that if everyone were to observe 2 Sabbaths in a row, 2 bedhead days in our vernacular, then the Messiah would come immediately, and all of humanity would be redeemed. Now, before you fire off an email accusing me of heresy, I'll quickly acknowledge that the when, where, and how surrounding the second coming of the Messiah remain a mystery to us all, and that according to Matthew 25, verse 13, we do not know the day or the hour when we will see him, which is why we're supposed to be prepared at all times for his return. Yes, 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 duly noted. And yet I think the Talmud is onto something here. I think the seemingly heretical and admittedly brazen statement says exactly what it means to say. If we as a people actually practiced rest, consistently, wholeheartedly, in unrelenting fashion, stuff would get restored in and around us that won't be restored any other way. In this manner, wrote Joe Lieberman, the Sabbath has the power to mend the breach that separates human beings from each other and from God, and that closing those 2 breaches will create the conditions for redemption. Which brings me back to the Good Samaritan. Because one man decided to live rhythmically, another man's life was saved. It's math that ought to compel us toward rest. 1 helper plus 1 who was helped equals 2 lives lived restored. When I compare myself to the Good Samaritan, I feel a little inferior, truth be told. Sure, maybe he didn't wake that morning thinking, I believe I'll hunt for an outreach opportunity today. But I'll guarantee you this much, he had margin to offer to God. He had left enough margin in his schedule, in his spending patterns, in his soul, that he could use in a missional way. This hardly computes in a Western mind. How can we be expected to do something for someone else when we can barely do what our own lives demand? I don't have to look beyond the guy staring back at me in the mirror to recognize that throughout my life, whenever I've passed by needs, as the priest and the Levite did, instead of coming and seeing and taking pity and helping, it's generally because I've been busy, or broke, or at odds somehow in my inner world. And I know I'm not alone. As I say, the tendency to place another's needs ahead of our own has never been a natural bent. This remains the case today, which is why across this country and around the globe, food bank shelves remain empty, school children remain tutorless, and neighborhoods decimated by natural disasters aren't ever efficiently rebuilt. We don't help because we already feel helpless as we manage our own and only insular life. We live life so chronically stressed out that those with needs all around us are simply out of luck. We even have scientific research that bears this out, the idea that harried people generally aren't helpers, that they're too distracted to do any good. In the early 1970s, social psychologists Daniel Batson and John Darley recruited nearly 70 students from the Princeton Theological Seminary and told invitees they would be participating in a study on religious education and vocations. This study is now considered a classic look at helpfulness and its Achilles heel, hurriedness. After participants completed a straightforward religious questionnaire, they were asked to head to an adjacent building, one by one, where they each would be delivering a brief talk, either on the types of jobs seminary graduates would be good at, or on the parable of the Good Samaritan. What participants didn't know was that, en route to the adjacent building, they would encounter a man in distress, a plant courtesy of the research organizers. The man would be found lying in a doorway and doubled over in apparent pain. His eyes would be closed. He would be moaning and, as if on cue, he would cough exactly twice as each student approached. The students would surely be caught off guard. Had the man been hurt? Was he drunk? Either way, their knee-jerk reactions to the situation would help answer the question being studied. Who would stop to help? The experimenter's hypothesis was that the more hurried the student was, the less likely he or she would be to help. Therefore, they manipulated the study by giving each participant one of three sets of instructions. Students were told that, 1, they were late and should hurry to the adjacent building. 2, the assistant at the adjacent building was ready for them, so they should head right over. Or 3, it would be a few minutes before things would begin at the adjacent building, but that they might as well make their way to the site. Participants then were unwittingly divided into three categories: high hurry, medium hurry, and low hurry. In addition, as you'll recall, half were told to prepare to deliver a talk on job prospects, while the other half expected to give a talk on the parable of the Good Samaritan. In this way, researchers could assess both circumstances, the urgency factor and motivation, what was currently on their minds. It came as no surprise, really, when only 10% of high-hurried students offered any sort of help to the man in need. The harried aren't helpful, remember? Furthermore, only half of those who were headed to the adjacent building to deliver a talk on the Good Samaritan offered to be a Good Samaritan in any form to the suffering man that day. I found this note from the researchers interesting. Some participants in this category literally stepped over the victim on their way to the next building. A conclusion among several was this: ethics become a luxury as the speed of our daily lives increases. In other words, we don't have time to be do-gooders when doing good will take too much of our time. We can do better than this, can't we? We can meet needs in a needy world, can't we? Please, please tell me we can. I want to believe that we can. And yet, even as my desire skyrockets for believing this way, I come across articles such as this. stress levels for Americans have taken a decidedly downward turn across the USA, except for young adults, whose stress is higher than the national norm, says a survey to be released Thursday. Those ages 18 through 33, the millennial generation, are plenty stressed, and it's not letting up. 39% say their stress has increased in the past year. 52% say stress has kept them awake at night in the past month. And more than any other age group, they report being told by a healthcare provider that they have either depression or an anxiety disorder. The study goes on to say, one in five adults in this country between the ages of 18 and 33 is clinically stressed out, depressed even, and in need of medication, fast. We've passed hurry on to our kids. Our stress is their stress now. Something in me says it doesn't have to be this way, that we can reclaim our lives and theirs for peace. We can change. We can and we should. What's the alternative, really? Spiraling out of control, passing on the death spiral to our kids, and all of us leaving this planet totally exhausted someday? What kind of life is that? If we stay where we are, Anne Lamott wrote, where we're stuck, where we're comfortable and safe, we die there. We become like mushrooms living in the dark, with poop up to our chins. If you want to know only what you already know, you're dying. You're saying, leave me alone. I don't mind this little rat hole. It's warm and dry. Really, it's fine. But the little rat hole isn't fine, is it? Are we really okay with turmoil and pain? Are we really here, slathered in poop? I dare say the answer is no. Keeping our appointments with God. I was talking with a friend recently about the benefits of rest, which is what I tend to be talking to everyone about these days. She was lamenting the rigors of raising young kids, explaining how she couldn't rest. Too much to do, too little time to do it, and on it went. I think she wanted a pass from me, a little permission, maybe some grace. What she got instead was a sermon, and a really good sermon at that. Here it is, free of charge. As she was talking, whining, the thought occurred to me that Adam and Eve ultimately missed out on an entire lifetime of rest because they missed a single critical appointment with God. As the book of Genesis tells it, the only thing the first human beings had on their to-do list was a restful, easygoing meeting with God. And yet it's the one thing they didn't get done. From the very beginning, the environment God had put them in was peaceful, restful, and good. The Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, Genesis 2 verse 9 says, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. This was a place of abundance. This was a place of calm. And yet the day came when they did what God asked them not to do, and the tranquil enoughness all went away. They ate from the tree God said not to eat from, and sin unceremoniously entered the world. At the end of Genesis 2, it says that Adam and Eve were so at peace in their garden that they felt exactly zero shame. No shame is the perfect description of two souls beautifully at rest. But then comes chapter 3, perhaps the greatest read-it-and-weep story of all time. The setup is a familiar one. Satan, disguised as a serpent, speaks to Eve, challenging the instructions God had given to her. Eve, now persuaded to eat from the tree God specifically said not to touch, takes the fruit and consumes it, and then passes it to Adam, who follows suit. Immediately they are changed. Their entire world has changed. God then takes a walk through the garden and calls to Adam, "Where are you?" To which Adam says, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." Verses 9 and 10. From there, the truth tumbles out, as the truth always does, that Adam and Eve had defied God's orders and thus separated themselves from the beautiful intimacy with Him they'd known. God responded to this situation by detailing a laundry list of sufferings that humankind would now face, and then He expelled His firstborn creation to a far less idyllic way of life. It was a contrast that was hard to miss. Where there had been quiet strolls, togetherness, evening breezes, and a pervading sense of peace, There were now deception, blaming, enmity, and strife, not just for now, but for always. In the flash of an eye, Adam and Eve were robbed of many things, all their own doing, of course, but the greatest loss, I have to believe, was the permanent loss of rest. There is the sense, as you read of the effects of their sin, that they'd have to scratch out a living the hard way from now on, that a deep-seated rest would no longer be theirs. In refusing to be found by God, they compromised a lifetime of rest. We'd shake our heads in astonishment over the stupidity of such neglect, except that we're just as guilty as they are. On 1,000 days, in 1,000 ways, you and I also hide from God. But perhaps, unlike Adam and Eve that day, it's not that we don't want to be found by our Heavenly Father, it's that we're not sure we remember how. Human society has moved far east of Eden, wrote Brian Zond, but we still retain in memory the promise of paradise and how we long to get back to the garden. But is it possible? We know a lot. We have amassed information. We possess sophisticated technology. But we don't know how to find our way back to Eden. We've wandered so far east. If I had to pinpoint why I'm writing this book, it is to convey one message. You haven't wandered so far east of Eden that God's rest is not near to you. It was a single critical missed appointment with God that thrust everything in the wrong direction, and it is a single critical kept appointment with Him that will begin to set everything right. Tiny disciplines tend to win great wars. When we quit hiding, even for a moment, God says, "I'm here. Let me give you rest." And then from that place of restedness, I'll help you to be light in a very dark world. Let's quit committing spiritual suicide. I'm back in the habit each Sunday morning of closing New Life's worship services with a passionate plea for the entire congregation to go home and take a nap. And based on the Monday morning tweets I've been getting, the weekly exhortation seems to be working. I hear about record-breaking snoozes, drool-soaked pillows, entire halves of televised football games missed, the whole works. And I can't help but smile. This is good news to me. Our people are learning to push pause on all that needs to happen in their world and simply surrender to rest. To keep Sabbath means to stop, Carrie Kent said. Stop working. Stop telling people what to do. Stop running your household. See if you can model restfulness well enough that your calm pervades your home and even your family. I'm watching this unfold in and around our church, and I assure you, it's a welcome change. What I'm really telling them, up there from the platform, is this. Just for today, quit being the master of your universe and yield to God instead. Be available to Him. What I'm saying, in a soulish sense, is be willing to be found. Last week, one of the guys at New Life took his family out to lunch after church and then went home and took what he described as a monster nap. Good for him. Hours later, he woke and told his wife he was headed to the gas station a couple of miles away to fill up their 2 cars for the week ahead. He returned after refueling the first car, and when his wife happened upon him, he was rifling through a basket of umbrellas the family keeps in a hall closet. When she asked what he was up to, he said, "It's pouring outside, and there's a couple standing in the rain on the interstate, right at our exit. I figured they could have one of these." I should tell you straight up that this story doesn't have some world-altering ending. The guy drove the family's second car over to the gas station as planned, and on his way he was prepared to roll down his window and offer the drenched couple an umbrella and any other help they might need. He was disappointed to discover that the couple was no longer there. But the outcome is not what I homed in on. His availability is. This New Lifer was findable. He was findable to his God. I want to be findable to God too. I want to live life like that every day, accessible, available, and all the way alive. To live all the way alive is, in the words of Eugene Peterson, to explore the unforced rhythms of grace. Matthew 11, verse 29. What does exploring those unforced rhythms look like? It looks like bringing life to those around us, not out of obligation, but out of overflow. It looks like people who simply can't help but to be helpful to those who really need help. It looks like at last having eyes to see. We see the neighbor whose car won't start, the clerk with distant eyes, the mom of young kids juggling both a stroller and a shopping cart, the couple standing on the corner in a downpour, now soaking wet. Yes, we still see our to-do list. We're trying to mow the lawn or buy the groceries or get gas and get back home. But somehow our priorities have shifted. The people have trumped the task. Well-rested light in a very dark world, if you'll recall, this is how we come alive. It's a bold vision, I realize. If you survey our relational landscape today, you'll see we have a long, long way to go. We're disconnected from one another, even in this age of connectivity, electronic style. But is this a surprise to anyone? You and I both know in our gut that a one-on-one interaction beats the virtual kind every time. And yet still, we while away our time with our smartphones in hand, tweeting and posting and commenting and emailing, failing at every turn to truly connect. We're as glazed over and distracted as those young conference goers in our church's parking lot I told you about at the beginning of this book, noses glued to technology's latest thing. We're alive, but you'd hardly know it. We're dying before we're dead. A recent report shows that more Americans now die of suicide than in car accidents, and that gun suicides are almost twice as common as gun homicides. It's a sobering statistic, this idea that so many are taking their own lives. Here's what the current studies fail to report. The multiplied numbers of those who are committing suicide of the spiritual sort. We've allowed ourselves to die inside. We have no life to offer to a world flatlining before our eyes. We've got to pull together. We've got to engage real time. We've got to help the helpless. We've got to come alive. We've got to embrace rhythmic living so that, as Wayne Muller encouraged, when we go forth to heal the wounds of our world, whatever we build, create, craft, or serve will have the wisdom of rest in it. What a compelling concept. It's the difference between eating fast food and sitting down to a meal that has been prepared with patience and love. A vast difference, wouldn't you say? I dare say the same is true when we parent from a place of peace, or lead a meeting from a place of peace, or have a difficult conversation with our spouse from a place of peace, or interact with a retail clerk from a place of peace, or do any of a thousand other daily things we're always finding ourselves doing, all from a place of peace. Everything goes better when that thing is done from a place of peace. Not only are we living the life that is truly life, but we're also spreading that truly life around. This is peer pressure in its finest form, really. This is who you and I both want to be. When we show up and when we share peace, we become the people we were intended to be. When Pam and I first arrived in Colorado, this would have been the first or second week of August 2007. It was for a three-week audition before the staff and congregation of New Life Church. For three consecutive Sundays, I was asked to preach my life messages, the sermons that demonstrate my view of God, my view of the world, and my understanding of what it means to be a Christ follower in this day and age. It was awful. I mean, it was great in that if I did well, I'd be voted in as the new senior pastor. But it was awful to feel like a contestant on a reality show, someone desperate for the applause of the crowd. The Saturday before my first Sunday talk, I was a nervous wreck. I wasn't nervous about preaching. I was nervous about the result of my preaching. Old demons came back to haunt me. What if they didn't like me? What if they didn't accept me? What if the best I could do was ultimately declared not enough? Pam and I drove around all day Saturday, checking out the city that we hoped would be our new home. I distinctly remember that we were on the far north side of town when Pam all but insisted we drive half an hour south to eat lunch at a particular Mexican food restaurant. There are scores of Mexican food options up north, which is why her demand was so odd to me. That, and Pam is almost never demanding. This was way out of character, in my view. To add to the oddness, I kept catching her, checking her watch there in the passenger seat. She seemed jittery, as though we were late for something. Of course we weren't. The only plan we had was to burn up hours until I stepped onto the platform Sunday morning to preach. Maybe she was just nervous about the audition. Given my own anxious state, that certainly would make sense. I finally conceded to Pam's wishes and navigated to the requested restaurant, a half hour's drive away, only to be told by her once we were seated that we couldn't order food yet. I looked at my wife, who was growing stranger to me by the moment. "But I'm hungry," I said, to which she said, "I'd like to wait for a few minutes. Here, have a few more chips." We were on our third basket of tortilla chips when the door to the restaurant flew open and four of my closest friends from Texas casually strolled in. Suddenly everything became clear. My best buddies had flown all the way to Colorado to be with me during my first weekend at what would be my new church. I jumped up and grabbed Morgan first, and then bear-hugged Peter, Sean, and Marcus each in turn. And then I exhaled every last concern that had been needlessly overtaking my heart. These were busy men, business owners and high-flying executives, each of them a husband, a dad, and yet they'd taken 2 days out of their schedules to come to me in one of my deepest points of need. I might as well have been lying on the side of the road, just like in the parable, bloodied and beaten to a pulp. Emotionally, my need was that great. And yet the mere presence of four devoted friends bound my wounds, turning fear to faith in a flash. They were doing their thing from a place of peace, and they spread peace to me as a result. We sat out on the back deck that night at the house where my family was staying and told the same old stories we've recounted 100 times and enjoyed in equal measure one another's company and a cool August breeze. They sat with me until 9 or 10 that night and then headed for their hotel as I made my way to bed. The following morning, I would turn around in my seat there in the front row of New Life's auditorium and see four familiar faces smiling back. I didn't know a soul in the vast congregation, but I did know these four men, men whose faces shone like pure gold. I rose from my seat when it was my time to preach, taking in stride the 8 steps to the stage. I delivered my talk in peace, amazed by my good turn of heart. My friend's presence was steadiness in uncertainty's storm, needed silence for my noisy heart. Richard Rohr says, "Silence is the necessary space around things that allows them to develop and flourish without my pushing." My four peacemakers had brought me to silence in all her glory. Silence, stillness, okayness. This is exactly what I craved. Living fully alive. All these years later, I reflect on that occasion, thinking, I wonder what radical things I would do if I were living fully alive. Think about it. If you and I had margin, if we weren't chronically stressed out, if we weren't forever dashing from here to there to there, I wonder what we'd do differently, what we'd attempt, who we'd become. 3 pieces of advice if you're interested in answering that question for yourself. First, unplug. Decide now that the rhythmic life is worth living, that peaceful describes the person you want to be. Next, be filled. Know what brings you alive and pursue it. Be intentional during unplugged times. And third, give your best away. Share your sense of peace with a world in chaos, letting the abundance of your life overflow. This is how we quit dying inside. It's how we come alive. The Fully Alive Unplug. A mom of a newborn mentioned yesterday that her baby has been awake the last 2 nights and has been sleeping the last 2 days and joked that maybe her little one is part owl. She said she and her husband never knew just how beautifully active the night sky was. They'd spent all those years sleeping through it. It's a common thing, evidently, babies getting daytime and nighttime mixed up. I know this, Mom. In fact, it was exactly 1 year ago next Tuesday that I told this now 47-year-old woman and her husband not to give up on having a child. They had tried everything infertile couples try, to no avail. But God spoke to my heart one day that this couple should not give up, and so I told them to persevere. They did persevere, and now, 12 months later, a tiny daughter lives in their home. It has been a long road for them, a wearying road for them, which is why I was so delighted to see she was taking this day-night mix-up in stride. I'm sure there are 1,000 baby psychologists out there with strong opinions on every newborn dilemma imaginable, including how to get your child to sleep when it's time to sleep. But here is what I thought as I listened to that loving mom. You are getting it so right. The books and blogs and theories and rants will still be there a few weeks from now. Today, keep choosing rest. Your baby will thank you for it someday. The same is true for us all. Now is the time for rest, for getting our bearings, for talking with God, for choosing to unplug. The dilemmas that need solving will still be there when tomorrow dawns. For today, let's agree to relinquish them, to drop our shoulders, and to simply pick peace. The fully alive get filled. Last month, I went to a pastor's meeting hosted by the senior pastor of another local church. Ironically, the meeting was about effective sabbaticals, how to enforce them, what they should look like, how long they should be. He had a written policy he gives to his staff. This guy meant business about rest. His basic premise was this. When we, and by we I mean well-meaning, Christ-following people who are trying to live rhythmic lives, finally agree to take some time off, a staycation, a vacation, an official sabbatical, whatever, we pretty much stink at being intentional with that time. And so my colleague created a policy to enforce core principles of rest. I balked at the idea of systematizing rest until he handed out copies of the rules, of which there were 3. Retreat, refresh your soul, and renew your focus. That's it. The 3 tenets of effective rest. He went on to explain to those of us gathered there that rest requires a plan, or else it becomes a superficial vacation, a rigorous academic leave, or an unhelpful escape. This, of course, begged the question from several of us, what does your plan usually involve? He was preparing for an upcoming sabbatical, as it turned out, and he was more than happy to reveal to us his plan. Well, I'm going to a bluegrass music festival, he said. I'm going to take my guitar and write some songs and watch the sun go down and drink beer. This elicited some chuckles from the crowd. In his button-down Oxford, Argyle sweater, and old-school pleated pants, this pastor looked more like an accountant than an artist. You guys think I'm joking, he said, laughing. But I tell you what, I'm not. And then he said this, which stuck with me for weeks following the session. You've got to know what makes you come alive. He said that a few days in an environment like that, being outdoors, meeting new people, listening to great music, ditching work clothes in favor of shorts, would utterly renovate his heart. He'd be able to reflect and write and breathe in ways he's not able to while at home. After the collective group had a few more good-natured laughs at his expense, he told us how he'd hatched the grand idea. I was journaling one day about what makes my heart race in a good way, what makes me feel most alive, and what I landed on was all this, music, warmth, sunshine, and so forth, and so I built my sabbatical around those things. What began as a light-hearted discussion ended on a gut-level note. This guy had hit on something big. We all should make such lists. What does make me come alive, I wondered. And so began my own introspection, a journal, a pen, and me. For starters, my list included palm trees, salty air, and an ocean within walking distance, warmth, the sound of seagulls squawking nearby. When Pam and I were first married and were living in northwest Louisiana, miles and miles from any semblance of a beach, we had one of those sound machines that played ocean waves. I'd listen to that thing every night and be transported in my mind. I know I live in paradise, here in the Rocky Mountain region, but the ocean is what really makes me come alive. Of course, my list also included international travel, spending time immersed in a different culture, surrounded by different sights, sounds, and sensations than what I experience in my daily life, is a sure way to bring me life. And then there was sitting outside during a rainstorm, preferably on a covered porch. 20 minutes later, I'm a man reborn. And finally, a little solitude, being alone in the presence of God. We don't think about this question enough, but we ought to. What makes us come alive? What makes our pulses race, our hearts soar, and our most challenging circumstances for the moment fade to gray? I think about the Good Samaritan and wonder what had fueled his act of kindness toward the man on the side of the road. Had he spent the previous day watching a rainstorm, enjoying a good novel, taking his kids to the beach? Mission requires margin. One thing we can be sure of is that somehow he'd been filled up. The fully alive give their best away. Several months ago, Abram and I were having breakfast together at a local cafe and spotted a couple from New Life sitting a dozen or so booths away. They were deep in conversation, and so we didn't approach. As far as I know, we weren't noticed by either of them as the hostess led us to our table across the room. After we placed our order, I asked our server if she was also covering that table, the one where the New Lifers still sat. "I'd like you to add their bill to ours without their knowing," I said. She smiled conspiratorially and said, "No problem. Consider it done." I had met with this particular couple just a few months prior when they requested a conversation about their current financial mess. They went on to enroll in money management classes New Life offers, and I had received an email from the husband saying they were getting back on track. But still, the $20 tab would have to be accounted for, and when you're dead broke, every dollar hurts. After the server headed back to the kitchen, Abram asked what was going on. I didn't want to betray the couple's confidence, even to my son, and so I simply explained that when God gives us an extra $20, or an extra 20 minutes, or an extra 20 anything, there is nothing better to do with it than to quickly give it away. Mission requires margin. There it is yet again. It's a lesson I'm still learning, and one I hope to pass along to my kids. When you and I seize upon that lifestyle of rest, that lifestyle of healthy rhythms, that lifestyle of bringing life and not death with us wherever we go, not only do we live fulfilled, but we also help point others toward the fulfillment we so desperately sought. Yes, it's true that we can't give what we don't have, but equally true is that we can give what we do. When our cups are full, or at least are not bone dry, we have a reservoir from which to draw. Jan Johnson tucks this idea into the context of our weekly ritual of going to church. "Simplicity leads to greater abundance in life," she wrote. "Because disciplines of simplicity, think margin, findability, peacefulness, rest, create more space to experience fellowship with God, we no longer drag our impoverished selves to church every week to get fixed spiritually. For example, if we decide not to spend time on the internet and take a walk instead, we have a chance to ask ourselves what we're most grateful for today. With such a God-nurtured lifestyle," she continues, "we don't need a maximum-style weekend experience to get us through the week. We begin trusting God's very own self in daily life so that when we fellowship with others at church, we have more to give." And then this, my favorite line of the entire passage, "The abiding life overflows." You and I are overflowing with something, I'll guarantee you that. Either we're overflowing with peace and rest, or we're leaving turmoil and chaos in our wake. If I get to pick, I pick the former, not the latter. I want to bring good stuff with me as I come, and leave good stuff behind me long after I go. What I've wished for, I'm now experiencing, a life so filled with abundance that it overflows like that Sabbath night Kiddush cup. I am reminded of the way Eugene Peterson reimagined Psalm 23, verse 5, and I take heart. You revive my drooping head, verse 5 reads. My cup brims with blessing. I whisper it to God as a prayer of thanksgiving. You have revived my drooping head, Lord, and now my cup, it overflows. Breaking busy. Challenge number 1. Dream a little. Spend a few minutes thinking about what you would do on others' behalf if only you had a little more margin in your life. Without editing for feasibility, jot down on a piece of paper the ideas that come to mind. Would you host a dinner party for the new neighbors who just moved in 3 doors down? Would you sign up to serve at the soup kitchen downtown? Would you agree to help out in children's ministry? Would you take time out of your precious weekend to visit someone who is homebound or imprisoned or hospitalized? Would you help tutor underprivileged kids? Would you show up at the weekly prayer meeting? Would you invite the guy who is homeless to come have lunch with you at a restaurant for once? Let your thoughts take you wherever they want to go. Your only job here is to record them. Challenge number 2. Live out that dream. Now start living your dream. Maybe not the full list all at once, but at least some part of that list. If a little extra margin in your life would mean hosting a dinner party for your new neighbors, then step 1 here is simply walking down the street, introducing yourself, and offering to help carry in moving boxes. Have a conversation. Let that be step number 1 in your new rhythmic way of life. The other steps will come once you agree to make that first move. Consider coming back to your dream list throughout the year and see if God doesn't afford you custom-fitted opportunities to make every last one of those dreams come true. We hope you've enjoyed Addicted to Busy, an Oasis audio production, directed and engineered by Dirk Gowans. Text copyright 2014 by Brady Boyd. Production copyright 2014 by Oasis Audio under arrangement with David C. Cook. Oasis Audio titles are available wherever audiobooks are sold and on our website, oasisaudio.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.